This is United States v. Salas, 17-2098.
Good morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Mark Robert, and I'm here standing in for Dennis Candelaria, who represented Mr. Salas in the District Court in Las Cruces below. I'm an assistant federal defender in Albuquerque. Mr. Salas was apparently living in what was described in the reporting as a shed that was a part of a property on which a house sat. The shed in which Mr. Salas apparently was residing at the time, law enforcement became interested in Mr. Salas and the place where he was living, and executed a search warrant there. Once some things inside the shed were found, a member of the bomb squad from Albuquerque was called and reported to the location, and a number of things were found that were alarming to the officers who were present, some of which were determined to be things possessed in violation of the law, and some of those things were determined not to have been possessed in violation of the law. We're here today to talk about a couple of those things, which increased the total number of what was considered to be firearms or destructive devices above the 8 threshold that occasioned, in this case, an increase in the guidelines offense level by the number of offending devices being between 8 and 24 instead of 0 to 7, increasing the guideline sentencing range. We're here specifically to talk about two silencers, or things that were characterized as silencers by the agents and ultimately by the court.
Is it clear that this hoard of weapons that was found did not include any pellet gun or BB gun of any nature?
The record indicates that is correct, Your Honor. Now, what we don't know is what might have been inside the house to which this shed was appended, or what was found in the shed which was not reported. I have no idea what that might have been, but clearly, on the record that we have before us, there's no indication that there was an airsoft pistol or rifle or any other sort of toy or false or fake firearm that's involved. And, of course, the reason that we're talking about that is because the two things that were considered to be silencers in this case were two devices that were manufactured for use with an airsoft weapon. And, of course, an airsoft weapon is I don't know if it's a BB gun or it shoots plastic pellets, but it's something that's not a firearm. It doesn't discharge a projectile through the use of explosives like a regular firearm does.
Would it work on a gun that uses a gunpowder explosive?
The record before us would suggest that it does for two reasons, and I'll come back to some distinguishing points on that issue. But first, apparently there were traces of nitroglycerin found inside one of these things, and according to the testimony, that trace suggested that at some point in time, an unknown point in time, that some actual bullet gunpowder was fired through it. And the other thing,
they found some books or manuals about silencers. Were those put into evidence, and did they talk about silencers for air-propelled guns and say that those silencers could be used for explosive-propelled guns?
The answer to the first question is yes. There were a number of books that were found that addressed a lot of things. The Anarchist's Cookbook or Handbook, they couldn't decide which. There's a thing called The Poor Man's James Bond, which is something that was new to me when I read the record in the case. Things that addressed how to make or fashion sorts of weapons, devices, out of things that are readily available. There's nothing in the record, Your Honor, that indicates that any of those books contained information about how to retrofit an airsoft silencer. And again, that's something that's intended to reduce the sound of an air pistol, to modify that for use on a real firearm. Now, the other thing that indicates that these things could conceivably be used in that way is that when they were tested by the ATF to determine whether or not there was any reduction in the sound generated by an actual firearm, in this case a .22 caliber rifle that was seized at the scene, that somehow they attached these things to the muzzle of that rifle to conduct the tests. What we don't know is what was necessary in order to modify those things to allow their attachment to the rifle for the purpose of conducting the test. It's unknown And I think this is an important aspect of the calculus that we're asking being that should have been engaged in here.
But the decibel results were put into evidence.
The decibel results were put into evidence. I would submit that also in the record before the court is an attachment to Mr. Salas's objections to the pre-sentence report in which the reduction that was reported by the ATF was equivalent to, 143 to 125, which reduces it from beyond the threshold of pain to just above or just below a 200-member marching band and just above front row at a rock concert. So although there was some discussion about whether or not there's any quantitative requirement in the reduction in the sound, certainly to the extent that these so-called silencers are intended to reduce the report of a pistol to that which we hear in the movies, a little pop, that's not what happened here. So clearly there was some quantifiable reduction, but it wasn't such as to conceal the existence of the report.
So, counsel, are you – I want to make sure I'm understanding your argument now. I thought you were focusing your argument on whether the government had to prove some kind of scienter here relative to these items, that the defendant had knowledge that of the characteristics of these items as silencers. Not an argument that they are not silencers, but more of an argument about the mens rea, mental state of the defendant. Am I understanding your brief correctly?
Yes, Your Honor. Forgive me for wandering off that path.
All right. So my question to you is how our decision in Saavedra doesn't block that argument. It seems to me that in that case, we said that there isn't. The guideline doesn't have a knowledge requirement. We don't read it into the guideline.
Well, that argument was made, obviously, by the government. One of the problems that we face here is that we don't know what the district court did with all of this.
Well, no, I'm just asking you if your scienter argument has support in the case law.
Your Honor, we submit that it has support in the guidelines.
No, I'm asking about our cases, Saavedra and then before that, Ray. Aren't those cases dispositive here that there isn't a knowledge requirement?
I don't know about dispositive, but certainly there's no support in Tenth Circuit case law for the argument that we're making now. There is support, I think, that we draw from Staples and then the wording that's included within the guidelines.
Well, but Saavedra talked about Staples and said where a statutory sentencing provision doesn't have such an element, we've declined to impose a scienter requirement. And then from there we say that precedent applies to the advisory guidelines. I'm trying to see how you get around that.
Well, here's our reasoning, Your Honor, because we do believe that the statute does contain that scienter requirement. That's what Staples said. Okay, so Staples said that, of course...
Where is it in the guideline? Where are we going to find it?
In the commentary that relates to this offense.
This application note 5?
Yes, that talks about unlawful possession. And unlawful possession, necessarily by that, those two words, import what the statute has to say. And the statute was interpreted by Justice Thomas in the Staples case as including a scienter requirement. And it says that the requirement is that the defendant be aware of the factual characteristics of a device that make it a firearm. In that case, of course, it was a machine gun. It was an AR-15 that, possibly unbeknownst to the defendant, had been modified in a way to allow it to be to function as an automatic weapon. But that notion that the defendant must be aware of the characteristics of the device that cause it to be illegal, that separate it from innocent possession. And, of course, the mere possession of an airsoft silencer is not illegal. It's only illegal if there is an intent involved. And the intent here, we submit, is informed by an establishment of the knowledge of the defendant of the characteristics of this device, which turn it from something which can be innocently and non-criminally possessed to something that violates the law. And because Staples says you have to make that determination in concluding that a person has violated federal firearms law, and because the guidelines say that unlawful, emphasis on that word, possession, is what is involved that generates the application of the enhancement, that's how we get to the guidelines requiring a finding of intent on the part of the defendant.
If intent is required, and that's a big if in light of Spadra, but if it is, why didn't the district court make a sufficient finding of intent here? I'm quoting the district court. There, the U.S. has shown by a preponderance of the evidence that defendant's intent in possessing the silencers was to use them as silencers and that they were illegal. Why isn't that a finding of intent?
Because it doesn't specifically say that we can that the district court determined that Mr. Salas was aware of the characteristics of the fact that these things could be used as silencers and firearms.
He made a finding that the defendant had the intent of possessing these silencers to use them in an unlawful manner.
Well, that's what he said.
He knew they were silencers and that they were being used in an unlawful manner. Well, that's the only thing silencers do is reduce the explosive sound.
Your Honor, the quote that I take from the district court's written order.
The U.S. has shown by preponderance of the evidence that the defendant's intent in possessing the silencers, was to use them in an unlawful manner.
Okay. That's what the district court said about intent. And the ... was, and explosive mines.
Yeah.
And so part of the issue that I have with this, Your Honor, is that the district court lumped these things in with certainly what were characterized as explosive mines, which were some of the devices that were considered to be in violation of the statute. So he's looking at the entire shed and the things that it contained, black powder, shrapnel, pressure cookers, these sorts of things, and makes a generalized conclusion that Mr. Salas had, and again, to quote where you're looking in the judge's order, to use the items in an unlawful manner. What he doesn't say is, I specifically find, as Staples requires, that Mr. Salas was aware of the characteristics of those silencers that make them silencers under the law, as opposed to legally possessed silencers for air guns. And specifically, what information is there in the record other than the fact that there was this myriad of things that were alarming in this shed? Was there any there's no indication in the record, for example, that these two things that were ultimately concluded by the court to be silencers. By the way, there were four things altogether that were initially considered in that way, and two were eliminated because of their physical characteristics. Nothing that indicates that those two silencers could have been attached to any firearm that was found in the shed. They were airsoft silencers legally possessed for use with an air gun. Nothing in the record indicates that they could have been used with anything that was an actual firearm in that shed or any other firearm. It's unknown.
Are you saying then, I mean, there was specific reference to the silencers in the passage that was just quoted, and it also said intent to use the items in an unlawful manner. Is there some distinction between intent and knowledge?
In this situation, I think there is, Your Honor, because what the judge seems to be saying in this phrase, he's going to use these things in an unlawful manner. Well, that could easily be construed as saying, well, he's going to use these things to commit a crime. He's going to go out and hurt somebody. Well, that could be an intent to use the entire collection of things in a way that would ultimately be considered criminal. It does not necessarily address the critical question.
But using the silencers to hit people over the head with them and knock them out, is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not making any specific suggestions of the sort, Your Honor. I'm just suggesting what the district court said was way too general to be able to satisfy the requirements of Staples imported into the guidelines, which I think would be required in order to apply the enhancements that were applied in this case. I think I'll save 37 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Paige Messick again for the United States. Your Honor, there are two flaws in Salas's argument. The first, he's saying the district court got the law wrong, that the court didn't require the government to prove that he knew that these were silencers for real guns as opposed to toy guns. That's incorrect for the passage that Judge Ebell read. There's really no way to possess these with an intent to use them in an unlawful manner without knowing what their unlawful characteristics are in the context of the district court's opinion. There's no argument below that Salas was maybe intending to use these silencers in an unlawful way that doesn't involve their essential nature as silencers. So the district court was not referring to hitting somebody over the head with a silencer. It was clear that the court had specifically acknowledged in its opinion that the defendant is making an argument about knowledge. And the government, in fact, below agreed that knowledge was the essential element in dispute. So if you look at the context of this proceeding, what he was arguing and what we were arguing in response, everybody agreed he had that we needed to show knowledge. And the court held us to that burden, and we met that burden.
Are you conceding now, that you needed to show knowledge?
No, we are not conceding that on appeal. We certainly proceeded that way below on that assumption, and we met that standard. But so I do think that there is an open question as to whether Staples applies here in a guideline context. I would love to take the Saavedra case, Judge Matheson, for everything that you suggested it might be worth, but I do feel compelled to point out that Saavedra wasn't addressing this particular guideline provision that has that note about unlawful possession. And so I think Saavedra is still helpful, though, in explaining that we don't read anything extra into a guideline here, but we do still need to look at what the underlying statute requires in terms of mens rea. Well, Staples says that the mens rea for a criminal offense under 5861 is knowledge of the unlawful characteristics. But 5861 is not only a criminal statute. It also serves as the basis for seizure and forfeiture of weapons that fall under its purview, and that's 5872. So where the Supreme Court is saying we read this in for purposes of a conviction, it doesn't necessarily read that scienter requirement into the statute standing alone or for any of its purposes. And so I don't think you can say for the guidelines that the guidelines necessarily have to import the scienter requirement for a criminal conviction, since this is just a guideline enhancement and Saavedra says that we don't do that. So I do think it is an open question. It's an interesting question. It's not one that we pressed below. We're not pressing it here, but we're not conceding that we did need to prove that he had knowledge.
But you are conceding that under the rule of the case or the law of the case or the party's conduct in the case, that it was tried with the understanding and agreement that intent was required.
Yes.
Because when we judge instructions or evidence all the time, sometimes the parties put in an erroneous instruction and we say, gee, you didn't need to have that instruction. But if that's the way the case was tried and presented to the jury, you're going to have evidence on that erroneous instruction you all agreed was the standard of law. So you're saying here they did agree that intent, or that knowledge at least, was required.
Here we...
Not explicitly.
We didn't explicitly agree that. And it wasn't a trial. This wasn't a question submitted to a jury where we told the jury that they had to find knowledge, right? And so, but we did make a showing sufficient to establish that he had knowledge by a preponderance of the evidence. And that consists of Salas had a book on silencers in his shed. That book contained information about how to make silencers. He also had several other build-your-own-firearm kind of references.
By the way, did that book address adapting a silencer for an air gun to other types of firearms?
That's not in the record. What we have is that the books contain information about how to build your own silencers.
Is it in the record that these particular silencers had residue of gunpowder on them?
One of them did, yes.
That's in the record.
Yes, that is in the record.
There's no evidence that Mr. Salas actually was the person who fired a weapon that deposited the nitroglycerin on the silencer, is there?
No, there's not. There's not. But that is one piece of evidence, and I would point out that Salas conceded that that evidence was relevant, that it had been fired before he realized that the government actually had evidence that one of these silencers had been on a real gun and fired. So that's one piece. There is the material, the instructional material at his shed. There's also, when you look at the other things he had there, explosive devices, components for making explosive devices, 5 or 6 pressure cookers. You come away with the idea that this is somebody who knows what he's doing when it comes to weapons. And then third, there is the evidence that he had many real guns in his shed, but he didn't have any airsoft rifles, and that supports the inference that the silencers were meant to be used on real guns.
Is there affirmative evidence that there was no airsoft gun, or you're implying it from silence rather than from affirmative evidence?
That's right. We are implying that from silence. There's no indication that there was a real gun, and the government argued there's no real gun anywhere here. And given that, if there were
by real gun, you mean air gun?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
yeah,
sorry, I got that
gun.
Exactly backwards. There are plenty of real guns.
Yeah, and so you meant to say there was no
right.
air gun.
There are no air guns. And hearing that, it would be natural for the defendant to point out, actually, there were air guns found there. You're forgetting about the one in my mom's bedroom or whatever. But I think it is fair to infer that there was none. In any case, these 3 or 4 pieces of evidence together established by a preponderance of the evidence that Salas did know of the characteristics that made his possession of those devices illegal. And if it were a close question, it's not clearly erroneous for the district court to have found that the government did meet its burden. I would be happy to answer any other questions that the panel may have. Or if there are none, then I will just take my seat. Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate counsel's pointing out that the guideline section in Saavedra is different from the one that we have here, and there's no indication in Saavedra that the commentary to that guideline section included the unlawfully possessed, which takes us back to the statute, which takes us to Staples, which we believe imposes a scienter requirement with respect to the imposition of an enhancement on the basis of this statute. I do think that the track through the law is clear, that scienter is required, that the district court failed to find it, the evidence failed to support it, and I ask the court to reverse the sentence. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We appreciate the arguments. Case is submitted, and this time...